You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Hi, I'm Aaron Klein, a fellow and policy director here at Brookings at the Institute of Business and Public Policy, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here today. We're hosting an event here to talk about how to make financial technology, or fintech, as it's become, work for working people. It's my hope that through this conversation here, we're going to be able to really delve into some of the substance about this new technology, which has exciting promise to transform the way that all of us in this room conduct our life, our basic financial services. If we'd had this conversation 15 years ago, perhaps the panel would be talking about these new concepts like online banking. And if anybody said 15 years ago you'd be able to deposit a check from your bedroom, you probably would have laughed at them. I know we never thought of that when I was in Congress and we did the Check 21 Act, the enabling legislation to do that, less than 12 years ago. So here we are now opening our conversation on financial technology. And we're going to do things a little bit differently than we thought. For those of you who worked in the United States Senate, like myself, you appreciate the fact that member schedules can be a little bit unproductive, too. Thank you, Mr. Freud. And so I think what we're going to do here now is start with the first panel, which is a group of actual business entrepreneurs and people who are in the space right now talking about financial technology. Then hopefully we'll be joined by Senator Warner to hear his thoughts, and then we're going to close with a thought, a panel of government and regulator expertise who are in the trenches trying to figure out how this new coming world of financial technology interacts with our existing world of financial regulation. And I think getting that answer right, if we can do that, we're going to allow the entrepreneurs on this panel to innovate and make our lives a lot better, and we're going to allow the regulatory world to make sure that our financial system is safe and sound, and that the regulations and the implementation that the products that these folks create work for working Americans. So with that as the backdrop, it's my great pleasure to introduce Rachel Witkowski. Rachel, you read Rachel all the time in the Wall Street Journal, and before that, many of us here read her in the American Banker. She's an expert on the questions of bank regulation and financial technology. It's my understanding doing the fintech conference circuit quite a bit. So it's our great pleasure to get somebody who really understands these details on an in-depth basis, both from a Washington perspective and a business perspective. So Rachel, please take it away.
Thanks, Aaron. Good afternoon. Welcome, everybody. I am honored to be here. I might have been oversold there, but I appreciate that. It's my pleasure to introduce the panel to you. What I'm going to have them do is each give a brief overview of what they do, who they work for, and then we'll launch into a Q&A and then an audience Q&A. So I'll start from my left.
Sure. Nat Hoops. I run the Marketplace Lending Association, launched earlier this year by Lending Club, Prosper, and Funding Circle, three of the leading lenders that used to be known as peer-to-peer and now are more commonly known as marketplace lenders. And we're looking to grow the group to invite all tech-enabled platforms that meet borrower-friendly criteria. So we're in growth mode and focused on advocacy and public relations here in Washington.
Nadeem Hamsani, I'm the co-founder and CEO at EarnUp. We're a startup in San Francisco. Before I talk about what we do, let me talk just for a second about the problem. There's 200 million Americans with debt, and that debt amounts to $20 trillion. That's pretty incredible. So let's pause there and $20 trillion and think about that for a second. And that certainly feels like it's insurmountable, but we believe it is surmountable. And that's where EarnUp comes in. EarnUp intelligently automates the way people pay their loans and gives them savings and gets them out of debt faster.
Quentin Farmer, one of the co-founders of Even. We're based in Oakland, California. So we're looking at income volatility, specifically folks that have substantial paycheck-to-paycheck income volatility. So just as one group that we serve, 70 million Americans work for an hourly wage. Those folks often have a substantial change each paycheck-to-paycheck. The way Even works is We are a smartphone app that connects to people's existing DDA or prepaid card. We analyze that account for historical income, use that information to predict what we call an even pay, basically the amount that you'll take home each paycheck. When you earn more than that amount in a given pay period, we automatically save money for you. So it's a time of surplus income. When you earn less than that amount in a given pay period, we send you an advance, a way to make sure that that income is smoothed out and you're able to meet your obligations. So we're still a small team, just 12 of us in Oakland, but we're currently working with employers to serve their employees as a benefit. And so that's our business model. Employers pay us a flat fee, and there's no cost at all to the individuals that use us through their employer.
My name is David Reiling. I'm the token bank on the panel. And I'm the CEO and chairman and owner of Sunrise Banks in Minneapolis. Sunrise is about an $800 million financial institution. It is also a certified community development financial institution by the U.S. Treasury. We're also a B Corp, as well as a member of the Global Alliance of Banking on Values. So very much a mission-driven organization. I would say if you think of us in this fintech space, the reason that we have at Sunrise is we really believe that we provide a greater access to more convenient, transparent, and affordably priced financial products and services. We do that in really two ways. We do that what we'd call hand-to-hand combat, person-to-person relationships like you might think a community bank does, but we also do it through business partnerships like with the fintech organizations that are here. And so that puts us into a very interesting kind of strategic realm. There's really two halves to our business. One is what you might think of from a traditional or place-based type of community bank. We serve the urban core of Minneapolis and St. Paul. A lot of commercial lending for jobs, affordable housing for shelters, and a lot of nonprofit organizations bank with us because we're mission-aligned. The other half of our business is really in the payment space. We're in the prepaid card business. We leverage that platform to really help underserved populations access the payment system, as well as we have a small dollar loan product that's responsibly structured that we deliver through the employer, through employers to employees. If I had to kind of give you the ethos of Sunrise Banks, it's about mission and innovation. We have a unique innovation process to navigate through the regulatory process as well as do business with financial technology companies. In our space, it's a relentless cultivation of new ideas and opportunities, and we filter those or what we call propel them up or down quick. Then they go into a quick governance process in which we're going to develop how to put them into place in the marketplace. And then, like all new things in life, they need a little nurturing or check and balance. So for Sunrise, on average, we do about 2.5 new product services a year and have since 1997. So it is in our DNA to do this type of thing. So love financial technology companies, have a blast talking to them because of the fact that everything is possible.
Thank you. So my first question to all of the panelists are, what are the real challenges, the financial challenges that the everyday American, working American faces, and how can fintech be a solution to that?
I'll jump in on on one product that I think most people in this room probably have, and that's the credit card. The credit card market is really dominated by some of the largest banking institutions in the country, and that has meant that even as interest rates have gone sort of to zero due to Federal Reserve policy, credit card rates really haven't budged. And that's created an opportunity for lenders like my three members, the marketplace lenders and others, to jump in with a product that's more affordable for Americans in terms of the rate, and also more affordable because of the structure, because it's a term loan rather than a revolving credit product. And so I think the opportunity to kind of disrupt a core enormous consumer lending and credit cards are an enormous sector, and I think we're just touched the beginning of what's possible here in the space in terms of helping Americans not just gain access to credit, because again, if you're in a revolving credit card at 24%, you're not necessarily in a product that is, you know, maybe the most cost efficient way that you can access credit. You have an opportunity now because of financial technology to refinance or choose a product that is much more affordable. And so that, I think, it's not just access to credit in the United States, which I think is pretty widespread. It's access to affordable credit, and that's one of the biggest things that fintech is bringing to this sector.
I'll take a shot. One of the things that we see for your everyday American in this space, and this is doesn't really have anything to do with somebody's low income, middle, or high income. Not everybody speaks bank. Like, not everybody speaks government or speaks healthcare. So the fact is, in my opinion, one of the important things that fintech can do is simplify that, almost like a Google Translate. And the fact that, for example, my daughter, who's 17, she has a prepaid card. That prepaid card automatically puts together a budget for her. I had never gone through budgeting with her. Now she can see a sample of it. Now, she doesn't speak bank either, but now she knows what budgeting looks like. And she didn't have to do a thing. She understands the awareness of her account because the texts come to her automatically. So it simplifies a very complicated process in a lot of ways. And I think if we think about this for the average American, is that not everybody speaks the language. Even if English is considered your first language, you still have to speak the business language, no matter what sector you're going into.
I think I'm practically, like, contractually obligated to say volatility in answering this question. And I think this is an issue that is just now starting to get the attention it deserves, especially here in the States, right? So when we started even 2 years ago, there's all of these stories and research that have been done in the developing world on volatility and how it impacted especially low-income individuals. And my co-founder, when we started the company, actually wanted us to go abroad and work on this problem. And my answer to him was, no, we can do this here, just no one else is talking about it, which, if you're a founder, that's actually a good thing, right? Because it means you're a little bit ahead of the curve. And since then, you know, I think it has started to get more of the attention that it deserves. JP Morgan Chase has done some good research on the topic. U.S. Financial Diaries is a fantastic project that has informed a lot of what we do. Obviously, I spend more of my time talking about income volatility, but it's not just income. It's not just paychecks. It's benefits and the volatility that those might bring into your life. It's your expenses and how those change throughout the year. And so I think, you know, in general, whether it's at the financial institution level or other fintech companies, recognizing and really speaking the language of the consumer,
correct,
which is that volatility is their language, right? And we need to be meeting them where they are in building products and services.
I'll go next. We'll start with a little bit of data. I tend to be data-driven. 75% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. That's one of the problems. Another problem is that the majority of Americans can't survive a $400 unexpected expense without going to family or some other source of funding. So the problem is a bad problem to have. So where does fintech step in? Well, for us, nobody budgets anymore, and I'm not sure anybody budgeted before anyway. So society is particularly fast paced now. So where EarnUp comes in is we do the budgeting for the consumer. Not only do we help them set the budget, we actually do it for them. So perfect example of this is if you're one of the 75% of Americans that live paycheck to paycheck and you owe a $1,000 loan liability, let's say it's an auto loan, student loan, and maybe some and a mortgage debt, what we'll do is we'll take that $1,000 and split it into, and you get paid every Friday, we'll take that $1,000 and we'll split it into four equal pieces so that $250 is coming out of your bank account every Friday. And we take the consumer completely out of the budgeting game so that they don't have to worry about it. And there's some really interesting behavioral psychology effects that happen as a result of that. So consumers tend to be quite irrational, or said differently, quite emotional about the way that they spend their money. Mm-hmm. So one way to approach that is try to use logic to convince them to do otherwise, but we found that doesn't work. We've all been trying to do that for a long time. So what we use is try to play on their emotional level, which is to use behavioral psychology. And so there's a couple of interesting behavioral psychology things that happen as a result of doing what we do. One is because you're taking the money out along with their paychecks or the way that they're earning their money, what ends up happening is they spend, even though the money's out there getting ready to be paid for their loan, they have less money in their bank account. They feel like they have less money in their bank account. And so as a result, they spend less than they otherwise would. And the second behavioral psychology component, it's called the concept of relativity, is while 250 on that Friday that I talked about, 250 times 4 equals $1,000, nobody's going to disagree about that, the $250 once a week feels a lot less than that 250 times 4. And so as a result, what we're able to do is get consumers to add just a little bit of extra money onto each one of those payments So in this case, let's say it's $25 once a week. That $25 once a week feels like a lot less than $100 at the end of the month. And thereby, what we do is we accelerate the loan, reduce the amount of interest that people pay.
Obviously, there's a lot of solutions in fintech. On the flip side of this, where does fintech miss the mark in meeting the everyday needs of a consumer?
So I can go first here. Fintech does a great job of focusing on particular products. A lot of particular areas. A lot of fintech solutions are very niche. They tend to be focused on particular niche areas. In fact, niche areas that are focused on urban environments. In fact, many of those fintech products are created by individuals who work in those urban environments. And that's all well and good, but it, on average, fintech companies tend not to focus on the middle of America from an income basis, the lower middle income group of people. And I think that's a real challenge for fintech entrepreneurs is to focus on the average American, the hardworking American that's working a full-time job just to make ends meet or working multiple part-time jobs and is facing a lot of the typical challenge that the average American faces.
You know, I would chime in, and I think where fintech may miss the mark is fintech is usually geared directly at a specific consumer with a specific need of some kind. And if you're that consumer with that need, it fits very well. If your needs are something different, that might not fit you, and you have to keep searching for the right product or service. In addition to that, some of the missing the mark is product individual, where some of the instability comes in a person's financial wellness may have to do with the community that they live in. They may live in a more volatile community. That could be a household, that could be a neighborhood, and so as a result of that, that adds instability. In some cases, there's exploitation in a financial technology realm. So we can see that there are not all good players in the space. And so as a result of that, one needs to be cautious. You know, and I would say the last kind of aspect where fintech, we're having the conversation today around is, how does fintech fit into that political and regulatory space to make it really work for the consumer as well as work for the regulations that need to be complied with?
I mean, I think one thing where it is serving people really well, though, is as connectivity online just increases even further and further and further down the income threshold and even into, you know, some of our most remote rural areas, you have people who might not live near a bank branch but can come across, a highly competitive and, at least on the consumer side, very well-regulated market online and potentially access the best possible priced product for them that they might be able to access that they wouldn't be able to physically come across without being in a fintech, you know, pursuing a fintech product. So I think it's also important that while there's definitely, you know, room for all products and services to continue to improve and try to serve, you know, all Americans, it's also important to remember what we're comparing it to. And, even in the area of algorithmic lending, you know, we've seen a lot of problems in non-algorithmic lending, right, in terms of, people who are coming from protected classes at car dealerships or whatever not being offered the most affordable product for them and algorithms that are based on, you know, basic information that everybody is consistent across everyone offer kind of a level playing field that might not exist in someone's community depending on where they come from.
I wanted to spin off of the issue of budgeting. This is an everyday issue of, you know, overspending, bouncing the account. There's a lot of technology out there that does stop gaps in preventing people from overspending in their account. How do you balance providing that and guiding them into better financial decisions versus making the decision for them and forcing them into a certain direction within your own products and services?
Yeah, it's always that challenge between paternalistic versus letting the consumer make the decision. There's been a lot of interesting research that's come out of the Common Sense Lab in Duke University with Daniel Ariely and behavioral psychology concepts. And what they have been able to prove through a study of, you know, a meta-state of 300 other studies is that the only thing that works in terms of consumer finance education is just-in-time education. So there's a number of states, I think 9 or maybe 12 states, that have, as part of curriculum requirements, have required students in high school to receive personal finance management training, and that they found that the half-life of that training is anywhere from 6 months, 3 to 6 months. And that's incredible. They spent 3 years in class, and within 6 months, they only remember half of it, and within 2 years, it's all completely gone. And they have some hypotheses as to why that's true, mostly because a lot of people learn how to do financial management through their parents or through their family environment. The only thing that works is just-in-time education. And so what you need to do is, when people are making those decisions, you need to make it crystal clear, or you need to take the time explaining to them how those decisions impact them. And then you can provide them options. At the end of the day, it's a consumer's option as to what to do, but you can direct them through that education. You can direct them with that just-in-time information to make better decisions. Then the final piece of that is just notifications. Letting people know that they're in a particular situation and allowing them to make those decisions is critically important. And then automation associated with that is really important too.
If I could dovetail off of that a little bit on the financial education side, I think in a lot of different panels and things that I sit in, we have, and I'll use the term middle class, the middle class answer to this all is, well, we just need more financial education. Well, if in fact you didn't do very well in school, it wasn't a pleasurable experience, how do you think you're going to get somebody back to come and sit in a classroom and learn about something in a future state, right? Where your problem is of the moment or just in time. So it is not the silver bullet of everything. I can give you an experience. You're citing case study, which I think is really good. We have a partnership with Lutheran Social Services in our Eastside Financial Center, where we have people that just come in and talk about financial budgeting and counseling. And while their primary goal is to deal with a financial issue, what really ends up happening is they may have a daughter who's pregnant and is a teenager, and the fact is now they need to navigate the county health system in order to get benefits to make this thing work. And so the budgeting and counseling aspect is the reason they came in, but the real problem is some fundamental underlying issue, whether it's health or whether it's emotional. Those things are harder to deal with. It's a lot less straightforward as to debits and credits, if you will. It's dealing with humans and emotion. The one thing that I would say when we're working with people every day is don't have pity. The people that we work with are incredibly resilient and smart. They just have a tendency that they're living in a planning phase, which is right now, as opposed to a lot of it, in some cases, is paycheck to paycheck. And maybe for most people in this room, it's, well, you know, we think of budgeting and planning for the long term in retirement. And so as a result of that, decisions get made differently because there's different criteria. But it doesn't mean that this person is any less intelligent. They're just dealing in a different set of circumstances.
And to play off that, this is one of my biggest frustrations with our kind of fellow fintech companies, right? You just talked about really meeting the individuals that you serve in a really personal way, and in a very intimate way, really understanding what's going on in their life. And in Silicon Valley, we have this mantra of like, talk to customers, talk to customers, talk to customers. And it seems like fintech firms just completely forget that. And it doesn't make any sense to me, because more than almost any other sub-industry of technology, that's where we should be doing it the most. The very first hire we made at Even was a user researcher. It was not a popular choice with our investors. They wanted us to hire an engineer. But she has ended up being an incredibly foundational part of how our product has come together. Every day when our team, rides the BART into our office, they're listening to a podcast that she put together, which is interviews with the people we serve, talking about the features that we're working on building that day, right? And so that kind of connection, I think a lot of companies miss out on. And that means you end up with these questions on panels like this of like, well, why is fintech paternalistic? Well, it's like, well, because you're not talking to the people you serve. And so I think that's something that the industry as a whole could come a long way on. I see some progress. I see people starting to think about this more. I see people copying us and hiring user researchers early on, which I'm totally fine with. But I'd like to see more of that, and I'd like to see more of that type of engagement.
So between fintech firms and traditional banks, who do you think will ultimately provide better financial solutions for consumers?
I'll take a wag at it. I think fintech will. And the reason I say that is we've got to move the model. I can't honestly sit here and tell you that a checking account will save somebody's life. It doesn't. And because they have a certain financial product, it means that they're somehow banked or they're somehow saved or something like that. And that is completely a myth. We need better designed products that serve people where they are, when they want it, how they want it, and it needs to be in a form that they can understand. And I would say one other thing that impacts this greatly is, now Rachel had a caveat to this whole thing. She didn't want any fluff answers. So I'm going a little beyond my skis in terms of honesty here. But the fact is we work in a bit of a baby boomer mindset in terms of how we look at the world. And the fact is when I have a conversation with my kids, they look at the world completely different. And so I think there's a place for banks. I really do. And good community banks of how you might think them. But the fact is we need new financial services and products that really help the health and financial wellness of a consumer and customer.
So when I think about the products that I use every day, all of them were at some point, financial products, all of them were at some point fintech, right? Like when I swipe my credit card, that's technology. When I go check online banking, that's technology. So I think that, you know, looking at a point in time, sure, there may be some things that fintech is doing that incumbents are not, and vice versa. But when you look at over a longer time horizon, when you look at the evolution of the industry, I think what you'll see is that the best ideas are going to get incorporated into the incumbents that have the ability to reach the largest number of people. Even can only reach right now a very limited number of people compared to, you know, the number that you can serve. And so, I don't think there's an either-or question quite so much. The question is one of timing, of trajectories, and really how the two parties work together throughout that time.
There are a lot of partnerships as well that between banks and fintech companies that I think are really promising. So, for instance, Citigroup uses LendingClub to help fulfill its Community Reinvestment Act mandate, in part because, again, LendingClub is really good at reaching people in all areas and places that their branches may not reach, right? Citigroup's branches may not reach. And so I think those types of partnerships that you see emerging are, I think, helping drive more innovation and probably better services for borrowers and for investors.
So I think the jury's still out, and maybe the jury will be out for a long time. Banks have a very special place in society. They're critically important to society, and they are large institutions that take some time to move into different areas. And as I was saying before, fintech companies tend to focus on niche products for niche areas. The one advantage that, and reach, as Quentin was saying, is super important, right? So for our product today, it's very difficult for a small startup to get their product into every single bank in the United States, let alone the larger ones. So that reach, the incumbents definitely have an advantage with. I think the banks have, I guess I'd call it an escape valve, so to speak, in that at the end of the day, if a product is particularly attractive, they can do something really neat, which is go buy that company. Or they can go invest and build that product themselves. And a lot of the larger banks talk openly about that, which is, hey, this is really an important product and it's changing society. We'll just go acquire it, and we'll just or we'll just go do it ourselves. If they miss that, or if a lot of them miss it, then fintech wins. If they don't, then the banks likely win.
So to ping off of the partnership, how do you know who to partner with? And on the flip side, what keeps you from partnering from whether it's a bank or a fintech?
I'm happy to go. We do this a lot. So in who to partner with is always a huge question. And we've made more mistakes than, you know, I'd love to admit. But the fact is the first thing that we really have to do is make sure that there's a values alignment. If we don't share the same values, if there's a company who's looking to rape and pillage, that's just, you know, that's not us. We are for shared success. We want the fintech company to do well. We want the consumer to do well. We want the bank to do well in a relationship like that, all in a regulatory compliant way. And so part of that process is the value around compliance. In the products that we've had over our history, we generally find that compliance wins the long-term game. If you're going to shortchange that, you're going to get caught and you're going to have issues and mistakes. And so from there, we look from after the values alignment, obviously we do the due diligence like any bank would in terms of all the compliance that we have to meet. And from there, it's a push forward to trying to make sure that that thing gets done. And quite frankly, I disagree a little bit down when I hear that big banks are going to go buy fintech. I think the entrepreneurial spirit in the fintech gets crushed and lost, and it gets muddled in a huge bureaucratic type of, and I think the energy and the beauty of the product dies. And so, and maybe I'm just promoting myself in a weird way, they say, you know, deal with a more entrepreneurial bank because we want you to do really well and be here for the long term and have that success. It may not be the immediate exit that you need, but when we're looking for partners, we're looking for people who have a little bit more long-term trajectory.
From a fintech company's perspective, as we look to partner with banks, our perception is that the first thing, and this is a little bit about what the panel's about and the day's about, the first thing that banks look at and think about are compliance. It's just everything is driven by compliance. It's about compliance risk. It's about your particular policies around compliance, your vendor compliance. It goes on and on and on. And I think that's part of the question here, which is, should that be the way that it is? I think what we're talking about a little bit here is should the bank be focused on whether this really helps people, whether it's a good product for the bank, it's a good product for its consumers, or just consumers, whatever particular area that they're working in. So I definitely believe that the banks have an upper hand, so to speak, in that there's a lot of fintech companies that want to work with banks, and if compliance is ruling the day, then it's you know, they get to pick or they get to figure out, you know, who's got the best compliance programs or work with those companies to improve their compliance programs. And that makes it really difficult for small startups who have limited resources to be able to build those compliance programs up. So that's it.
So this is the number one question that I get from founders of other companies that are maybe like a little bit earlier stage than we are. And what I think the reason that this always gets asked, the reason that we talk about it up here, is that a lot of fintech companies don't view partnering with a bank as the same as any other type of partnership or sales process, right? You spoke to a little bit of the compliance and the things you need to think about. You know, we did not see this as a big challenge because, quite frankly, we just approached it the same way we do pitching investors or pitching new partners, right? We set up a process, we figured out what the needs in the market were, we figured out who were good kind of candidates to work with, and we went out and worked with them. And that involved putting together the compliance documentation they needed. That involved, you know, making them comfortable with the fact that we were going to be a good partner for their bank. But I think, you know, and this gets into a disconnect between the technology companies and the incumbent banks, fintech companies often kind of have this expectation that the bank is going to be like a utility for them, right? It's like turning on the water or like turning on the internet in your office. That's not how it works. It's a partner just like anybody else. And so I think that kind of rigor and that approach to really thinking through how you want to partner with the bank is what's missing and why this is a topic of conversation.
Well said.
So compliance is obviously one of the most challenging topics that I always hear at fintech and banking conferences. I want to dive a little bit deeper. What has been the most challenging rule, regulation, requirement that you've faced in the last year? What specifically has been the hardest to comply with?
The single biggest challenge for us is not any particular rule or anything like that, or even in one organization. It's uncertainty. Each time that you're taking a step forward as a startup, you kind of think about activation energy, right? So you're like a chemical reaction. It's like, what do we need to get to the point where we can raise money, that first seed round? What do we get to the point where we can have that first enterprise customer, so on and so forth? And the uncertainty that the current regulatory environment injects into each one of those stages just makes that activation energy requirement just a little bit higher. We have a group of us up here on stage who have largely surpassed that, at least, you know, a couple of the first steps. But the people that don't ever get over that first hurdle are not up here talking about what they're doing because they're not doing anything. They're probably working for Google or Facebook or God knows where. So I think that's what gets lost and that's what gets missed is this idea that it's the unknowns and the fact that as a founder who does not come from a financial services background, you really often don't know who you can even sit down with to get these questions answered. The titles of the people that ended up being most helpful to me early on were like totally opaque, and like I would have had no idea that they would have been like that useful, right? So I think that transparency is something that's really missing and is causing us to have fewer innovations, especially fewer consumer-friendly innovations than we would otherwise have.
I'll reference something that's not regulatory, but it's government, and it's really, I think, holding back the sector, at least in the lending space, a little bit, and that's the IRS. So the IRS has a great amount of every taxpayer's information, and taxpayers empower the IRS to share that information with third parties all the time. Unfortunately, so far, the IRS has not modernized its process to be able to share that key piece of information, which is a form called the 4506T, which is your sort of summary of your tax information, with a third party instantaneously. So even if they made that one change, which would be basically cost-free, the people that are online who are trying to verify that somebody's income as reported is actually what their income is and that they didn't create a false filing in order to apply for a loan, they would be able to do that verification instantaneously, and that would, again, help improve, you know, both the accuracy of the information that lenders are trying to use to improve borrowers, and then if that information were more accurate, they would be able to offer people better rates. So I think that built into online lending, unfortunately, is a bit of a fudge factor around the possibility that people are committing fraud. If the IRS could modernize its processes, that would make an instantaneous boost for the sector, and it's applicable in student loans as well. So people are now eligible for income-based repayment in student loans, but every year they have to go back and prove that they have low incomes by filling out reams and reams of paperwork and waiting for days and days and days to get the IRS to release information that the IRS already has and is empowered to share. They just simply don't use the technology that would allow it to be instant. And so rather than, I mean, I think there's obviously regulatory issues that are at play in, you know, in lending, as all lending is, but those kind of issues with the government would really help foster innovation, and that's the, you know, the, some of the work that we're going to be doing at the association.
I think one of the big dilemmas that a lot of fintech firms in Silicon Valley talk about, not just fintech firms and another a number of other startups in a bunch of different industries, is do you embrace compliance or do you act now and beg for forgiveness later? And there are a number of companies that have taken both routes. My advice and what we chose to do is to embrace the compliance aspects of the industry. It becomes a competitive and comparative advantage. I think the challenge for all of us to figure out is how do we ensure that those companies that are making the right decisions aren't getting penalized for that? And so I'll give you an example. I have a friend who, before they got funded, and that's always a challenge, you got to get a product market fit. And, you know, in a fintech space, it's difficult to product market fit if you choose to embrace the compliance components of it, because then you need resources to do that. And the only way to get resources is to actually test the product out. But you're not allowed to test the product out until you get the compliance aspects done. So it's a chicken egg kind of problem. So I had a friend who tried to start up a new age mortgage servicer company. And what ended up happening as they looked into the regulations is that every single state has their own set of compliance and regulatory requirements. They had to apply for a license in every single state. And the geographical boundaries that you know, once existed in the United States, or you know, with the internet economy, are virtually gone. And so if you're going to start a business like that, just focusing on California and applying for a license in just California doesn't work. You need to be able to be in the majority of states. And if you have to go to every single state, spend 6 months and hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, on legal fees and otherwise, and licensing fees, it's untenable.
Yeah. So with that being said, where would you guys like to see the regulators head in terms of fintech and fostering financial innovation without creating more risk? But at the same hand, where do you fear they would head?
I'll take a whack at that one. So again, not the fluff answer. The talk has been about around a fintech charter. Personally, I think that's a bad idea. And again, it's coming from, I don't quite understand the intent of the regulators as to where they are going with that concept. If that concept is coming from a place of we want to see better products for consumers and small businesses, or if it's coming from the standpoint of we want a direct pipe and control over more fintech companies, and we're not only going to do it directly through them, but through the banks that they go through. Ultimately, I think that hurts the innovation at the fintech level. You just have more layers of compliance. Now you have multiple regulators. Your bank is the pseudo one, and maybe one or two, depending on the size of the organization, as to who the potential regulator is. In my opinion, let fintechs be innovative and creative. Let the banks do compliance, and if they can't do compliance, don't let them be in that space. The fact is all the regs are set up there today, but I think there does have to be a bit of a sandbox in order to facilitate innovation. And the regulators are looking at that. I again think that's a challenging place for regulators to go. They can say they're going to have a little space and a little group that does innovation, but if you think about it, in my world, I mean, culture eats strategy for breakfast. If you have a little strategy of innovation in a sea of risk-averse people, it's not going to last, or it's not going to grow or foster or have any power. The fact is that it needs some independence, it needs some space. And there are times when products and services are just getting launched where you really need to test them. In my world, we test them on our employees. So we'll roll them out to the employees. Even then, that's a test environment we might get criticized for, even though it's very controlled.
I mean, I would say that there's a kind of a stark divide in regulation between do you have FDIC-insured deposits or do you not? I think that if you do and the taxpayer ultimately potentially stands behind guaranteeing your account, then there's a significant interest on the part of the government to impose prudential and, you know, compliance standards on that entity. If, on the other hand, you're in the business of, you know, enabling, you know, some other, you know, financial activity that doesn't, again, put the taxpayer on the hook, then I think, you know, there is an opportunity for regulators to potentially foster innovation, either through a charter or through another means. But again, I think that's sort of, if the regulators will look at it through that lens of, you know, is the taxpayer ultimately on the hook? That can help drive, I think, a lot of the way that they can sort of make sure that it's a sort of a potential promising avenue.
So there's a lot of good conversations about sandbox and charter and things like that. At least from my perspective, I think of those as very long-term conversations, and you know it's going to be a lot of work to get to that point, and that's okay. It should be. I think there's something that's much more immediate and much more pressing that we haven't talked about yet here, but is definitely an issue I think about from a policy and regulatory standpoint. Protecting consumers' ability to have access to their data and have portability with their data that they have with their financial institution, I think is one of the best ways available to us in the short to medium term to improve financial access and improve financial outcomes. So when I think about my relationship with my financial institution, right, they love offering me products and services, right? I'm exactly who they want as their customer. They want to give me a credit card. They'll probably want to give me a mortgage, although not if I live in San Francisco, so on and so forth, right? The people that we serve, though, don't have that luxury, right? Their bank is not trying to offer them a credit card. The only way that they can access the same types of services that I have the privilege of accessing in my institution is by bringing their data and going elsewhere. And that's something that there's already you know, the ability for the CFPB to encourage and support that's already on the books. And it's something that I don't think is being discussed enough. And I think it's the best way to protect the consumers who are currently least well-served by their existing institutions.
So I wanted to leave some time for the audience to ask questions to the panelists. Does anybody have a question?
Hey, thank you all for being here. I was just interested in how you each feel about blockchain technology and how you are or are not looking to take advantage of that. Is it security reasons? I mean, there's ease of transaction issues. What do you see as the advantages and disadvantages, and how are you looking to tap them?
We've looked at it in a couple of different venues and types of different products. I think it's really cool, quite frankly. I love the transparency in it. And again, let's not confuse the blockchain with Bitcoin. Let's put that aside. That the core technology underneath, I think, has fantastic applications, particularly in contracts. And as a result, I think there's a lot to be done there. I do, and I'm not quite clear as to how blockchain, when you put it into financial privacy, comes out in the end, because it's all apparent. It's all out there. And so I don't know how to try to get our head around the regs between privacy of information and the publicness of and transparency of the data.
So I'm an engineer, like first and foremost, by education and things like that, and I love a cool new technology, and I've spent plenty of my own personal time, like, you know, messing around with Bitcoin and blockchain and things like that. But going back to the stuff I said earlier about being very consumer-centric and how we design our product and build our product, as the kind of current state of blockchain exists, there's no real reason for us to incorporate it into anything we do, right? We need to be more closely aligned with the way consumers are currently banking and currently using services. So right now, it's not something that's really on our radar. Maybe one day, obviously banks are thinking about it, but I think we would be more likely to follow on that rather than lead the way.
Yes. Next question.
Hi, Stella Adams with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. And there was a couple of comments about fintechs partnering with banks around CRA compliance. Who's doing it and how's that working? And also, I'm the Chief of Civil Rights, and what are you all doing to ensure fair lending compliance is built in and locked into your products and services?
I'll just take quickly just the partnerships that, you know, Lending Club as a nationwide platform takes applications from all sorts of borrowers, and that means that for, you know, a big bank that has branches in various locations but may not have sufficient volume of applications for you know, CRA compliant products, they can build a partnership with a nationwide platform in order to achieve those goals. And so I think any further details you'd have to go into the company, but that's broadly the parameters of how it works. I think the promise of, again, online lending is that all of the same laws and all of the same regulations that apply to all loans apply to online loans. That's the beauty is that we have, you know, nationwide access, but the same fair lending standards and disparate impact and all of that applies. And so I think that, you know, all the firms that all the best platforms, you know, like you mentioned, they embrace compliance. So they're very, very focused on embracing compliance and actually seeing how the growing connectivity of people up and down the income platform, you know, up and down income levels can be utilized to help actually expand access to credit and expand access to affordable credit.
From our standpoint, so we've had an outstanding in CRA for 2.5 decades. So we live in that space. So from a CRA and a fair lending standpoint, that's an everyday thing for us. We have a multicultural company. So the fact is we speak 7-8 languages, and they're just in the urban core, Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so as we do our lending, we're looking more ways to access communities that have been left behind than the opposite. And so particularly in our mortgage division, we target on, look for customers of color and low and moderate means, and we basically have banks that come to us looking for CRA loans. Day in and day out, that's who we are and what we do.
Just as a clarification, though, it's the fintech firms who aren't insured deposits don't have to, they're not graded on CRA. They don't necessarily have to comply with it, so to speak, right?
No, well, but if you don't have insured deposits in branches, then yep. then some of those requirements wouldn't apply, because again, you don't, that's all tied to a geographic footprint. The entire statute is tied to a geographic footprint. Yeah. But I think what we're saying is that financial technology companies and marketplace lenders especially are actually finding that they're doing such a good job of finding and reaching those borrowers and reaching them with affordable credit that traditional financial institutions that do have branches are coming to them seeking the actual access to those borrowers.
To your point on the policy of CRA, desperately needs to be overhauled. In my opinion, we should throw it away and start over, because there are just some things that are, not from a concept standpoint, but for example, one of the antiquated things of CRA is you have to have a paper file in your main branch. Well, why not just put it online so someone can see it 24/7 anywhere they are and look at it on their phone? I mean, so there's some things about it. The core of CRA, I think, is valid and critical. And I think from that standpoint, the geographic aspect of it is starting to break down as well. You know,
Yeah.
Requirement that.
Yep.
What we're concerned about is
good question.
That they're we want to make sure that they're reaching the right people with the right products. We have horror stories about marketplace lenders who are raping and pillaging women entrepreneurs like me. When you talk about the average American, was I your face? An African-American small businesswoman. And if I wasn't, I can tell you that the marketplace lenders are charging ridiculous prices, and I don't have access to affordable credit through a financial institution.
Gotcha.
But I'm in place now.
Okay.
We're looking. Just want you to know.
Thank you very much. We have one more question in the back. 1 minute left.
This is mostly for lenders directly, but I noticed for the Marketplace Lenders Association, you said that banks are coming to you a lot to seek out customers that they wouldn't otherwise. I mean, I look at the data and you look at the big players there. You look at SoFi, great loans for great people, or some of the other guys, and they're trying to single out people with higher earnings potential because of underwriting that's, education heavy or something like that. But when you look at the originations by credit score, they're about the same as traditional finance companies. What do you guys think needs to happen in order to provide credit to the underserved who are highly reliant on alternative financial services, because the traditional consumer loan, a product of 1 to 5 year maturity, 5 to $35,000, that simply is not a good product for a large proportion of the population. As the woman who just asked a question mentioned, there are a lot of folks who just simply can't access credit. And when I look at a community bank like your institution, you're better at serving those unique customer needs. And how do we sort of commoditize that relationship lending? Do you see any obstacles to doing so currently there? And do you see any companies that are really making that leap?
I mean, I guess I would say I think the marketplace lending space as we define it is all sub 36% APR tech-enabled lending. So some of the high-rate products and payday loan products we don't consider to be marketplace loans. So that's first. So we're focused all in the prime and near-prime space and at affordable rates that are helping people save money compared to the traditional alternative. So if you think about a minority-owned small business that might have a credit card from a bank, the typical rate, if they can't pay the full balance, might be 24%. If you go on our members' sites, you're going to be refinancing that somewhere in the mid-teens often, right? So not only are you not continuing to pay interest on a revolving balance, you're actually getting an installment rate product and reducing your rate by a third, according to a recent large survey. So to us, I think the way we see the promise of marketplace loans is in, again, expanding access to affordable credit. Completely agree with you that there are a ton of people out there who deserve and qualify for better rate products, and they're ending up in very high rate products. And that's a kind of a market failure that we think technology is well primed to serve and solve. I'd turn it over to.
I'll give you a 5 second answer, and that is so we partner with a fintech out of San Diego called Employee Loan Solutions. So and basically offer a small dollar loan product through employers as an employee benefit. So they can access credit that is unsecured as opposed to entering and building their credit history in a secured environment. So we think the employer channel, for example, is a place that you can do that in a safe space.
I'm going to say a 5 second thing as well. Stop trying to shrink the existing products down to the right size for a lower income consumer. design new products that actually fit their life. That's my mantra. I'll keep saying it. I've been saying it, but that's what needs to happen.
Great. Well, please join me in thanking the panelists.
You got it, man.
It's my great pleasure here to introduce Senator Mark Warner. Senator Warner really embodies, in a way that I think few public servants do, kind of the full panoply of this conversation. Prior to entering public life, Senator Warner was a venture capitalist who founded and a capitalist who founded one of the largest telecommunications companies in America. After succeeding in the private sector, turned to become the join the public sector. Served as governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and is now in his second term as a senior senator from the state of Virginia. So if you could welcome, join me in welcoming Senator Mark Warner.
Thank you, Adam.
So I want to start by kind of asking what motivated, you've been a leader in this thinking about the gig economy, fintech, kind of all these different worlds melding together, and I think few people appreciate the breadth of what you're in charge of in the United States Senate, right? You sit on the Banking Committee, the Finance Committee, the Commerce Committee, the Intelligence Committee, right? Literally in charge of...
I'm not sure that makes me in charge of anything.
Dealing with the entire panoply of issues in the United States and the world. And you have the same number of hours in the day as every single person in this audience. What made you choose to spend so much of your time focusing on this issue?
First of all, thank you for having me, Aaron, and my apologies for being late. I had the day from you-know-where, where you have a one-hour dental appointment that turns into a three-hour dental appointment. So if I'm a little cotton-mouthed, excuse my presentation. I'm a big believer that a lot of politics should be more defined future versus past rather than left versus right. And I was lucky enough back in the early 80s to get involved in the wireless industry. I'd gone to law school at Harvard, and all my law school classmates were all at big, fancy law firms. And I kept trying to say, you know, we got to get involved in this whole cell phone business. Every one of them said to me, Warner, you are so crazy. Go get a real job. Who's going to want a cell phone? They are still practicing law, and I got rich off of that. I co-founded Nextel. And at that moment in time, people anticipated it would take 30 years to build out a wireless network, and at the end of those 30 years, would be 5% penetration. Obviously, conventional wisdom was wrong. So after the 2014 cycle, I started thinking, you know, let's take a look at this changing nature of the economy. I got initially interested in the gig and on-demand platforms, but relatively speaking, that is still a fairly small share of our workforce. We're still kind of in the hockey stick stage where it's going up. But what it led me to is something I think much more profound and frankly that I didn't fully appreciate, that most large corporates starting in the 90s, if you were not core to that corporate's function, you got outsourced. Whether it was literally abroad or figuratively, you know, a firm here at home. And we see that with people like cafeteria workers, janitors, what have you. And what's happened over the last 25 years is we now have at least a third of the workforce that is in some level of contingent work. 1099, independent contractor, two part-time jobs, short-term W-2. But the problem with that, and there are some great opportunities there, flexibility and other things, the challenge comes is that we're the only industrial nation in the world that built its social contract based upon your work status. You only get unemployment, workman's comp, disability, health, retirement, if you are in effect a full-time employee. That to me is a fundamental problem. We've got to create, I believe, a social insurance network that meets workers where they're at, and that, to my mind, means a portable benefit system. Who runs that system? How is it composed? That's subject of debate. Who manages these individual accounts? But I think from the first dollar earned, a portion of that dollar ought to attach to you and be broken into some of these categories. What particularly interested me in fintech is because of this change in the workforce, what we have now is enormous income volatility. J.P. Morgan's done a study, so it's about 60% of the workforce having a 40% volatility over a quarterly basis. We've all seen the Federal Reserve data that said 47% of Americans couldn't absorb an unexpected $400 bill without defaulting into one of the less than savory credit access. So what got me excited about fintech was, could fintech be, as we talk about with Evans and the others, this bridge? Because even if your income top line number looks good, if you are contingent and you have no ability to predict, could some of these tools accessed by your phone be a way to help folks manage through this changing nature of work and the changing nature of our economy? I do not believe we're going back to an economy where people are going to work for the same firm for 40 years the way my dad did. So I think we have to be willing to kind of lean forward and you know, meet workers where they're working. That means a portable benefit system. It also means fintech, while there are enormous challenges with it, has an opportunity to bridge part of that that new social contract. Last point, and then we'll get to the next question, which is, you know, if you were thinking about a social contract in the 21st century, I would argue that one of the most essential components of that social contract ought to be that emergency $400 or $500 fund that you can draw down, say, once a year. Because with the level of income volatility, stuff happens. And in the old economy, you might not make much, but you at least had predictability. You don't have that predictability, and fintech could be one of the tools to bridge that.
No, I think you're right, and I think that's what Quentin was talking about with Even, about the need to bring new products to address that the problem, and it's often misunderstood in small dollars, often the problem is income volatility, not expense volatility.
Right.
Right, the story that we're told about your transmission breaking down and that's why you need small dollar is true about 1 out of 6 times. And the other 5 out of 6 times, it's an income variance. But I want to pick up on a point that Dave made from Sunrise Bank, which was just stunning to me to hear bankers say a checking account isn't going to save your life. And he's right. And I'll tell you a story, you know, life imitates art. So on Saturday morning, I went to my local bank branch in Silver Spring, Maryland to deposit a check with my 3-year-old daughter.
And it's training early.
Yes. Lollipop equal bank equals lollipop equals good is the equation that I've impressed into her. But what struck me was there was a woman, African-American actually, at the teller next to me who comes up and says, "Here's a check. I need this to clear. When will it clear?" And the teller says, "This is going to clear on Wednesday." This was Saturday morning. Monday's Columbus Day. Check's going to clear Wednesday. She said, "Well, I have some credits coming up, some credits on my debit card that are automatically going to come up between now and Wednesday. I need this check to cover them." And the teller said, "Well, I'm sorry. It's not going to clear." She said, "What's going to happen?" She says, "Well, you're going to be charged an overdraft fee." "Well, how much is that?" "That's $36. "Was that only going to be once?" she asks, "or for each one? Because I have a couple of these." And the teller says, "Each one." She says, "Well, what am I going to do?" And the teller looks at her. Checking account isn't going to save your life. The woman behind me in line goes to her and goes, "Why don't you go to the check casher around the corner? They're only $20. And you can come back here with cash." And the woman looks to the teller and goes, "Well, will that work?" And the teller goes, "Yeah, the cash will clear in your account today." So she walked out of the bank. This is a banked person being sent to a check casher because our payment system can't deposit a check from Saturday morning until Wednesday.
That's crazy. I mean, it's crazy. And it is one of the, and again, the previous panel were the debate between financial institutions and fintech. Who's going to shrink that gap and do it with as least friction as possible? It's one of the reasons why I am very intrigued on the whole question around blockchain. You know, obviously there are transparency issues. We held one of the first hearings on Bitcoin. It took me a long time to kind of wrap my head around that and how that gets implemented. But it is crazy in the 21st century that it takes 4 days to clear for a check to clear. And you are both creating a business opportunity and you're also putting an enormous burden on a wide segment of Americans who just don't have that flexibility to go that extra week.
Right. That has no impact to me. The check clearing time doesn't matter to me, doesn't matter to a lot of people in the audience, but to the 75% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, that's real money out of their pocket. So how are we going to, what's government's role to fix this problem?
Well, I think government's role is to, one, encourage innovation. Two, it would be, when we think about all of the, particularly for that low-income person, the number of bills due to governmental type entities, whether it's the water company, the power company, you know, other kind of necessities of life, your taxes, you know, I think we really need to work with the incumbents on having a more flexible payment schedule in terms of what time of the month those bills are due. I think one of the interesting things that have attracted people to the gig economy is the fact that oftentimes that results in immediate payment. So the notional idea of, you know, do people really need to be paid every 2 weeks? Should they be paid every week or every day? These are all things that I think we ought to sort through. And I think, you know, if government at least starts with a more flexible basis on when it expects its payments to come in, that would be at least a step in the right direction.
Well, I think that'll be right. And I'd add, I think the Federal Reserve is the check processing clearing center of the country ought to get with the times and either force that or have industry force it. I think one of the nice aspects of blockchain and these other technologies that are coming out is they're motivating the incumbent banking network to move faster. And you see things like real-time settlement from the clearinghouse. I mean, the banking industry, I think, is seeing this threat of fintech and an opportunity.
But they're seeing a threat. But remember, for a long time, it's been a great profit center. Having these delays, you know, allows you to charge that overdraft fee. So this is this is why we need to encourage, you know, our fintech partners to kind of get out there to put pressure on trying to close down some of these inefficiencies.
So that kind of gets to the question about fin versus tech. And I've been thinking more about this word. It's a little bit of this awkward area where you have the financial folks thinking, I'm going to improve my tech platform. I'm going to go online. I'm going to have an app. I'm going to improve my tech platform. And then you have tech folk thinking, you know what? There's a giant opportunity for me in finance. And you're kind of existing in two different words. And the common hashtag up here has kind of blurred them together into one fintech. How do you see this? You know, with your experience from technology, your experience as a senior member on the banking committee, understanding finance, where do you see the worlds of fin
and
tech?
It may also, as we think more and more about mobile payments, you may have large other entities coming into the enterprise. You know, will the telcos suddenly be your bank? Will some of the social media companies who provide so much in terms of how we get our information, you know, will Google be your bank? So I think this is a kind of a little bit of a Wild West space. The challenge is how we allow innovation. I'm not there on the fact of a complete safe harbor because you could see bad products arise very quickly and, you know, how do you roll those back? I am intrigued with what's happening in the UK where they've got the Bank of England is, I understand, doing kind of a fintech accelerator. This is a space that we're going to, you know, as somebody who's interested in this, I need your input on how we get this right. I mean, because we've got to, I see my friend Jonathan Miller here, we went work long and hard on pieces of Dodd-Frank. Some parts we got right, some parts probably need some revision. But, you know, you've got consumer protection, you've got safety and soundness. Where does all this fit within a fintech new product world? I do think some of the comments about if you've got FDIC insurance, There is obviously going to be a higher bar on prudential, but there also has to be a consumer protection piece on the front end, because we have seen some of these products be almost advertised as too good to be true, and they have been too good to be true. They've actually ripped off folks. So I am anxious to have input on how we balance this.
That's incredibly important, because traditionally my marker for is a product predatory is it marketed on yes and fast? If something says you're pre-approved immediately, beware, right? That's usually, a telltale sign. And there are reasons, behavioral psychology reasons, as Nadine pointed out, that people have been denied credit. That's a huge psychological cost, and their desire to avoid the potential for denial again will motivate them, even if the terms of that product are less than stellar. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, one of the beauties of fintech is offering both a decision and immediacy, whereas the delay is in the existing system. But I want to kind of think a little bit about the future. I mean, you saw cell phones when folks didn't, right? When I was in Congress and we did this Check 21, it was all about being able to deposit checks in an ATM, and nobody saw this smartphone thing in your bed, in anywhere you want to deposit a check, and let alone Apple Pay and all these other new innovative forms. What if we're back here in 5 years, and you have the beauty of thinking in 6 year increments from time to time a little bit. Thank our founders for at least giving one person in Washington a longer perspective.
Although in terms of our record of output, even in 6 year increments, has been a little mixed.
What are going to be these innovations that you think, if all the keys are turned right, if government is a constructive partner, if innovations work, what are the things you're looking for that could change the fintech landscape if we're back here again in 4 or 5 years' time?
Well, I think if we see the fintech entities writ large improve access to credit, improve transparency, if we think as well, if gig and the changing nature of the social contract is not big enough, I also increasingly am worried that modern American capitalism in many ways is not working for enough people. And that is partially driven by enormous focus on short-termism over long-term value creation, which I think is a cancer eating at our system. And one of the areas where people are, that troubles me the most is, because people are not going to work for the same firm for a long time. Used to be if you went and worked for the same firm and you got hired on the factory floor, that firm would invest in you and upskilling you over a period of time, because chances are you're going to work there for 20 years. Now, there's virtually no rational incentive for any firm to invest in the upskilling and training of people, say, that make below $65,000 or $75,000. So when you've got globalization, when you've got technology, when you've got artificial intelligence, that wide swath of Americans are understandably pretty upset. And you see that from both ends of the political spectrum. I don't think it is an overstatement to think that fintech could be morphed into not only kind of better economic training, but there could be a whole series of other training delivery through your mobile device that might allow people to become upskilled. So I'm thinking that, how do we get those incentives right? One, I would argue that we need to think about, and I know this is a bit off topic here, but if we need to think about incentives, I believe business generally does a better job of workforce training than government, but potentially even looking at incentives that might go from a deduction to a credit and have that credit worth more than a dollar so that the company receives the benefit even if the person moves on. We've got to recognize we've got to have a much more aggressive way to upskill people in the workforce, particularly low and moderate income folks. And there will be an enormous number of intersection points. One of those intersection points might be your relationship with that fintech provider.
So I have one more question, then want to turn to the audience. And it gets back a little bit to the role of government. And Nat said something about how pinpointing the IRS and modernizing a specific form would be just a great way to unleash innovation. And I think about what President Clinton did with opening up GPS, right? Every time I am lost, I, in the back of my mind, thank President Clinton for opening up GPS. I don't think people fully appreciate that that innovation was brought to you by forward-thinking government. Now, I also had the opportunity to serve for Senator Sarbanes, who served on the Budget Committee, as did you. And I remember Budget Committee markups, which are kind of Wild West moments in the Senate, where amendments are putting out on the fly in their real-time votes. And one of the great offsets when you wanted to increase whatever it was that was your favorite increase was to slash the IRS technology budget. And so do you want more education or more IRS technology? Do you want more clean water or IRS technology, right? Real tough votes. And so, you know, I remember at one budget hearing the clerk had to interrupt and said, the budget is now negative. And so I'm sorry, don't worry, we'll fix that. But like, you know, and here we are realizing that the result of that is a lack of innovation because, ironically, we've kind of starved the parts of government that are necessary to unlock the private sector innovation. And so where, kind of my question to you is, where can government lead, where can government follow, and where does government need to get out of the way to unlock fintech?
Well, one thing, and we've seen this looking, for example, at the just the extent of the gig workforce. You know, BLS had not done a survey of contingent workers for more than a decade plus. That means that survey is about as valuable as it had been done in the 1890s rather than the early 2000s. We've tried to get the IRS to change some of the form in terms of retirement accounts so you can do it in a more simplified way. I do believe, and I'm relentlessly bipartisan, sometimes to the detriment of some of the folks that I serve with, but you cannot continue to have the starve the beast mentality about your general revenue collector. If you want that entity to be flexible and help meet people where their needs are, you can't default to that being the whipping post. And right now you've got an enterprise that is not able to deal with even late 20th century innovation, let alone 21st century innovation. So that's an area where, you know, a more efficient, effective government, I think, would be needed. I think there's, you know, one of the debates that we're going to have, you know, who owns your data? You know, who owns, you know, is it the social media? Is it your telecom? You know, can we allow the actual consumer to have access to full ownership of their financial data in a way that's a lot more transparent? That's an area where I think government needs to push that along. I think that getting this balance right between innovation and consumer protection is that's a hard one to walk, particularly when you've got products that can come out so quickly and be here for a while and then, you know, can wreak great havoc very quickly if we're not careful. So I'm, again, open for business on how we try to balance that right. I think we can't come in, we can't go back. One thing we can't do is, and I think about this more kind of where I was a year and a half ago on looking at the gig economy and the changes of the workforce. We are not going to fix the changing nature of our economy by going back to a binary choice in employment status between W-2 and 1099. It's going to need to be a much more robust, a much more flexible. I think the same kind of area, that same kind of approach of not backwards looking, but forward looking is going to have to apply as we talk about this subject.
Great. Well, I think we have time for a couple brief questions from the audience. If you have a question, raise your hand, state who you are, where you're from, and please ask a question. So who do we have in the back row right there? Yes. Yep.
Good afternoon, and thank you for a wonderful discussion. You talk about leaning forward and the IRS. Can we accelerate B Corp becoming the standard corporate structure so that we move away from this 501c3, 501c3D, whatever, that nonprofit, for-profit juxtaposition, so that corporations can invest beyond what's in it for them. You see the direction of SASB, the Sustainable Accounting Standards Bureau, locking in on working with the SEC directly on reporting. That's about valuation of assets. And if we're going to have a different social contract, we need to stop having chameleon eyes on nonprofit versus for-profit. B Corp is here. Let's make it federal and truly get over the wave of our history.
Well, let me try to address a couple points. One, I do think there needs to be an examination of fiduciary duty that meets the qualification of long-term value creation, not simply how much you can bring to the bottom line over the next two quarters, because frankly, a lot of stock owners now are not owners, they're renters. And something is fundamentally different. I grew up in the free enterprise system, but something is fundamentally different when you've seen the last quarter, 95% of all corporate profits spent on share buybacks and dividends and not in terms of reinvesting in enterprises, workforce, and training. You know, what gives me optimism in a place that is not always very optimistic is candidly millennials. I think millennials will vote with their dollars and their where they want to work in terms of working for and working with more responsible companies. I think this will be the case in fintech. And your comment about B Corp, I'm not sure that we're going to see a federally legislated B Corp. But I do think with B Corp, with SASB, Paul Tudor Jones has got trying to create a corporate ranking called Just Capital. I just came from a session this week in New York on a group that's called Inclusive Capitalism. There is a series of businesses around conscientious capitalism. What we need, I would argue, is these are all nascent efforts that have really kind of grown up post-Great Recession. But I have a lot of hope for this area. What I would hope, though, is that some of the funders and foundations could actually encourage these groups to work more collaboratively and come up with a single brand that consumers and others would recognize. Because right now we've got lots of furor going on, but to an average consumer, average millennial, they don't know where to turn to get that kind of metric-driven notions that an investor and a consumer could look to.
All right, so question, woman in the back, and then if it's brief, we'll have time for one more, so hopefully a carrot.
Hi, thanks for coming in today. Lalita Clozel with American Banker. So you mentioned that government should encourage innovation and finance. I was wondering if you have any specific ideas of what the banking regulators can do today to encourage fintech innovation.
Well, I think, you know, again, as the earlier panel said, you know, banking regulator always starts with prudential safety and soundness. You know, that's just their mindset. And candidly, we probably want them to keep that focus. I think one of the most important things that could happen is within the regulators, a lot more exchange between where fintech is at, more kind of back and forth discussion, regulators bringing on more people that are more versed in technology. I think this is less a single regulatory change than a recognition that the world is going to change, and it's going to change a lot faster than the regulators, I think, we recognize. And they're going to have to get up to speed on the tech space, I think, to kind of get that right. I'm not a very satisfactory answer, but I don't know what the silver, regulatory change that's going to get it right.
Great. Time for one last question. Ma'am?
My name is Melanie Avery. I work with an organization called Veterans on the Rise. It's a 501c3 that services homeless veterans and veteran families. And my question relates to the banking fees, the scenario that you brought up at the beginning of the panel. What will it take to convince the banking institutions to make adjustments in terms of how quickly and how efficiently they process those payments when they're making millions and billions of dollars of fees every year on that segment of the population that is living paycheck to paycheck?
Well, I would argue, one, people like me need to push the Fed to speed up this process. And two, some of our previous panel and others need to come up with products that will undercut the incumbent. You know, one of the opportunities around fintech as well is, you know, you can actually make it worthwhile to deal with much smaller amounts of capital. And the friction costs should go down dramatically. You know, this should be a great business opportunity. But we've seen some well-intentioned, but we've also seen some overreach even within fintech in the last 2 years that we have to be, you know, careful about. And that's, again, why I think transparency and being willing to call out the bad actors. I would argue that, you know, the notion of individual-to-individual lending was a lot healthier space before all the hedge funds got in. And so, you know, we have to just stay vigilant.
Great. Well, Senator Warner, I hope this chair was more pleasant than the dentist.
It was definitely a step up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mike, I'll introduce him, but this is actually slightly conscious for those of you who've been to a lot of different panels and events in Washington, around the country. Particularly in Washington, I think we often have the regulators go first and industry go second, and kind of part of a little hidden gem in here was the idea that we'd have the industry go first so that we could then have the government and regulators respond. I'm going to start by introducing folks as they get mic'd up. My good friend and former colleague Jonathan Miller is to my left. Jonathan is Deputy Director of Consumer Protection and Data and Research at the FDIC. Previously, he served as a senior staff member on the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, where he served Senators Dodd, Sarbanes, Kerry, many others, a graduate of Georgetown and Harvard. We're really pleased to have Jonathan with us today. To Jonathan's left is Adrian Harris. Adrian has one of the coolest jobs in Washington. She is a special assistant to the President of the United States. She serves at the NEC, where she serves our country and has been the leader on fintech, helped host a White House fintech event for those of you who were there. Prior to joining the White House, she worked at Sullivan and Cromwell. She clerked for the Southern District of New York and has a distinguished legal career and also a public service career, having worked for governors in New York, politicians in New Jersey, and now we're blessed to have her working for all of us in the White House. Last, but certainly not least, is Anjan Mukherjee. Anjan is Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury and Counselor to the Secretary. Prior to joining that, he served at Blackstone, where he was a senior investment banker, and then you had a stint in the Clinton Department in the education, in the Clinton administration. So really, you know, models of public service going in and out of government and the private sector. So with this distinguished panel, I thought we'd start off, and the great thing about having regulators on the panel is that they're data-driven and have resources to actually get data and information. So I thought we'd kind of go down and let everybody talk a little bit about the data and what they've seen from their actual time studying this issue. Jonathan, should we kick it off with you?
So will they?
Yeah.
And where will be up behind me, or?
Yep.
Okay, so Aaron, thank you very much for the kind introduction and to Brookings for putting on a really interesting panel. Enjoyed it. I learned something every time I do this. So I'm going to talk to you today about MFS for the little guy, so to speak, for working to make it work for all working Americans. And I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about our qualitative research, the focus groups we did with underserved consumers, exactly the kinds of folks that you heard discussed quite a bit. So the FDIC has, as one of its core missions, the goal of expanding economic inclusion for the underserved. And when we say expand economic inclusion, we really mean bringing them into the banking system, maybe a little old-fashioned from the previous panel, but that to us is where we really want our households, our American consumers to be. So this is a key focus for the FDIC. We do a lot of our work in conjunction with a federal advisory committee called the Committee on Economic Inclusion, a very diverse and interesting group. It's the focus of a lot of our consumer research. This is one piece. Another piece, which will be released next week, a week from today, as a matter of fact, is our biennial household survey on the un- and underbanked, which is really a treasure trove of quantitative data. And we also have offered a series of practical demonstration programs. For example, we've done a safe transaction account template, which I think we heard the question about the veterans and the fees that they suffer in the banking system, an effort to create a transaction account that helps people avoid those kinds of fees. And in fact, that template has now been adopted by a large number of very large institutions, is widely available. So the focus of this particular qualitative research we did, the hypothesis is that really we think mobile financial services, MFS, are uniquely positioned to address some of the needs that underserved consumers have in the financial system, and thereby will be able to contribute meaningfully to more sustainable banking relationships. So this is just a little bit of the research methodology. This is all available on economicinclusion.gov. All our data is on economicinclusion.gov, all the specific census data and the qualitative research data, et cetera. So I'll skip over the methods slide. And this is really briefly what we found. Sort of what we heard from our consumers is they think of their needs in that first column in sort of along seven dimensions. You can read them out there. You can see long-term financial management through access to money. And the second column then is their perceptions as to how they see banks meeting those needs. And you can see on some of the key areas, control, convenience, affordability, and access to money, banks are seen as very weak in meeting those needs for consumers. And then the last column, I guess I'm pointing in the wrong direction here. So in the last column, you see the same sets of consumers' views of how mobile financial services compare as a channel for meeting those needs compared to the other options they have. And you can see on those crucial crucial needs, consumer control, convenience, and affordability, in particular, they see that as superior. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. So what you see here in slide four is that mobile financial services really have a positive impact on three of the most important functions that underserved consumers, low and moderate income consumers have, and the needs they have from the financial system: affordability, control, and convenience. So, control. They recognize that MFS can help them increase their sense of control through greater access to account information. We've talked about this, through mechanisms such as automated balance alerts and up-to-date transaction histories. Convenience. Low and moderate income consumers, consumers living paycheck to paycheck, put a premium on their time and their effort. And anything that can save them the time, save them effort, is really value added to them. It's really meaningful to them. And they see MFS, and in fact, MFS is an effective way of saving time and effort. And finally, affordability. The kind of transparency, the kind of access to account information can really help consumers avoid fees that we've been discussing. Now, just to back up for a quick second, there are other areas where banks are seen as strong. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But an area that we heard Aaron get a little passionate about, access to money. This continues to be a real frustration for low and moderate income consumers, consumers who are living paycheck to paycheck. A part of it is, and to a certain extent, the MFS is helpful, but not sufficiently so. So this is an area where I think we all need to do a little bit of work, and I think the effort to make the payment system much more responsive would be very important. MFS can deliver the information timely to the consumers, but and I'll talk about that in a second. But they, but the, but the information, the data is not yet timely, and that's what an improvement in the payment system will get to. So sort of our strategies to improve economic inclusion through MFS. This is really the core of the work that we do. So one, increase consumer control over finances by improving access to timely account information. So it's not just the timeliness of the information, particularly until the payment system gets fixed. It's the ease of understanding, the accuracy of the information. So this woman decides to put her check in because she can afford to wait till Wednesday. It'll show up on her account. She looks at her phone. She sees what it is. Well, does it tell her exactly the day that the cash, that the money is available to her, or does it make it look like she's got money in her account that then she uses to, she writes a check or she swipes, and it turns out not to be there? So it's both make it easy to understand as well as timely. Expedite access to money, we talked about that. That's really, I can't underscore that, the importance of that enough. These, again, paycheck to paycheck, they put a paycheck or another a credit into their account. They need access to that money. And they're willing, by the way, to see their money go out faster as well, as long as they know what's in and what's out, really in and out. Third, making banking more affordable through better account management. Alerts, low balance alerts, very important, very useful, actionable in real time. That's really important to them. They want to know while they're online at Target, can I afford to buy this? It informs their spot decisions, and it can be incredibly useful to them. Address real and perceived security shortfalls. They hear about hacking. They get very concerned about this. A lot of their concerns are probably may not be accurate, but that's part of the educational process that banks have to do. Many institutions have these tools available. Unfortunately, some of their account holders don't know what's available to them. So increase awareness of mobile tools. Setting up mobile accounts when you open the account with somebody is probably a way to expedite that. And finally, encourage long-term financial management. This is an area where banks already have a competitive advantage. This segment of the population sees banks as very strong in this area, delivering longer-term tools to help people manage their finances into the future. For example, encouraging savings. We heard some about that. Just real-time, just-in-time education decisions that help set them up in the future. Those are the kinds of strategies we think banks can follow. And the end result of this, we hope, is far more sustainable relationships between this group, paycheck-to-paycheck consumers, which I didn't realize 75% of the households, and their financial institutions.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. Adrian?
There's so many good things that Jonathan hit on that I want to build on as well, and thanks for having me. And it's good to see lots of familiar faces in the audience, although the one drawback to this community and how well, how tight it is that when I see people who I owe emails to, it makes me turn my head like this. There's been a lot of themes, I think, that Senator Warren hit on and Jonathan hit on and the first panel hit on, and I just want to talk about two of those. The first is, it's very expensive to be poor, right? I mean, you hit on it in your story. Some of my friends in the audience who've probably heard me say this too many times have heard me tell the story of a woman named Jane and take the audience through the first 15 days of her month and how much Jane will spend just to have access to her own money. And it's a significant portion of her income. And some of that is just that financial services are not meeting the needs of consumers, and some of it is just an old financial architecture, I think all of which now we have the tools to remedy and improve. The other thing, you know, that some of Jonathan's remarks and others is, you know, we talk a lot about financial literacy and education and protecting consumers from predatory products, which are all good things, but I often like to remind people, nobody understands money better than poor people. Right, to your point, it doesn't matter to you if your check hits on Wednesday or Monday. There's money there. But for people who are paycheck to paycheck or very low income, often they know, right, when their check is going to hit and when the withdrawal they made is going to hit their account. And they know that cashing a check at Walmart costs $3 versus the check casher on the corner that's $5. And these are all insights I think we would do well to incorporate into our policymaking, into product development, whatever it is. And the insights that, Jonathan brought up and others, I think, inform that very well. So all of this talk that we have about fintech, I think, whether it's from consumer-facing innovations or systemic innovations, I think should really keep those things in mind. I mean, it's very much what Quentin was saying, right? You sort of start with the end in mind, start with the consumer in mind. Even if you're thinking about an institutional innovation, it should really be about the ultimate consumer. And how is what you're doing, if you're a regulator, a policymaker, a private sector entity, how is it serving those ends? And it was so funny to me when the senator mentioned the social contract. It made me actually think about my law school application, which I wrote all about the social contract and how going to law school for me was about learning the social contract from a government point of view, but also thinking about, because I've always had an interest in business and financial services, what does a social contract mean in a business sense? And financial services is such an interesting place to think about the social contract from a social point of view and from a government point of view as well as from a business point of view. It's such a great place to think about the intersection of those things and how financial services and for-profit entities in financial services serve these broader social ends. And a lot of what we talked about at the FinTech Summit in June was just that. What does fintech mean for these broader social policy goals that we care about? What does fintech mean for access to credit for small businesses? What does fintech mean for income smoothing? What does fintech mean for financial inclusion and financial health? Maybe you are actually pretty well off from the sense that your income maybe far exceeds your expenses, but it doesn't mean you're necessarily financially healthy. How can fintech help with that? We talked about fintech and economic competitiveness for the country, right? So all these other things we care about, and financial services in a lot of ways is at the foundation of that. And think as we think about fintech and the evolution of financial services more broadly, like these are all the things that we should be thinking about, whether we're regulators or policymakers or people in industry. So I thought that was so interesting that he brought up the social contract. It really warmed my heart. The other thing I just want to hit on a little bit is, Jonathan mentioned spot decisions. And as we think about all these innovations in financial services, and there's any number of products now that have made it easier for people to save or manage their money, but there are lots of products that make it easier for people to spend, right? It used to be that you would take cash and coin out of your wallet or out of your pocket, and like you had a very tangible sense of the money that you were spending and if the thing that you were getting in return was worth the number of bills you were counting out. The same was true when you would be at a cash register writing checks. It became slightly less true when it was just a card that you were swiping, less true still when you're sort of tapping your phone. And now as people sort of talk about geolocation in payments, right, my phone knows that I am in a place and I sort of pick up an item and you can walk out the door and pay for it without touching anything at all, right, the Uber sort of experience. How are we helping people think about money and the way they're spending money, right? We're making it so much easier to engage in transactions, but we haven't much changed the way we teach people about money in this environment where it's just so much easier to move money and manage money. So the spot decisions, to me, is something that's really important because and regardless of your income or your socioeconomic status, right, I sort of dream about the day where there's a product, hint over here to my friends, where, I'd walk into a store and my phone, I'm in the grocery store, and my phone would say, Adrian, you typically spend $200 in the grocery store. If you spent $150, and for me that probably means like no Oreos and no tortilla chips and all the horrible things that I eat all the time, you can, if you save $50 and take $30 and put it in this 529 and $20 and put it toward your credit card, and with all the appropriate sort of disclosures and protections, like if you would go ahead and put the Oreos back, but contribute to your 529 and put your thumbprint on the phone, right? I mean, that sort of education and innovation, I think, getting consumers at the point where they're making a decision, and again, regardless of your place on the income spectrum, are the kind of things I think are really exciting to me in the context of all the things that you've talked about before, consumer protection, systemic protections, and the like. So I think, you know, as we watch this space evolve, again, for me, it just goes back to who is the consumer for any given sort of product or service? What is it? What sort of ends do we want them to be able to meet, or objectives do we want to serve for them? And then taking it up a little bit, what are sort of the social ends that we want to be able to serve through helping these consumers reach their financial goals? And as I think about my job as a policymaker and how we think about fintech and how we engage with stakeholders in the ecosystem, those are always sort of the questions that inform my dialogues with people.
I think I just saw Nadeem and Earn Up start thinking through what the app is to get the Oreos into paying down your student loans.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll take the Oreos.
Anja?
I was just going to say, that was a pretty good elevator pitch. So if you start working on that business plan,
I'll help January. You out.
Exactly. Well, thank you. You sure you don't have the draft already on your free time?
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Aaron, for having me here as well as part of obviously a very important discussion that you're organizing here today. I wanted to hit on a lot of the themes that Jonathan and Adrian just mentioned through the lens, maybe a narrow lens of segment of the fintech world that we at Treasury have been doing a deeper dive in, namely on online marketplace lending. And then I'd love after that, as we get into the conversation, broaden out. We at Treasury, we're doing a lot of work on financial inclusion and literacy, finding ways to expand access to credit. I hope we get a chance to talk about all of that. But I wanted to use my opening time here as maybe a little commercial for the work we've been doing on marketplace lending. We put out a white paper recently here, and hopefully we have copies here. Hopefully you all will take a look, take one home with you and take a look at it. You know, at Treasury, we, as you've heard some of our other agencies describing, we're essentially interested in ways to foster the growth of innovation, safe and responsible innovation, and find ways to expand access to credit. And we found that marketplace lending was potentially an area, an emerging area of interest in that regard. And so we decided to do a little bit of work on this. We issued a request for information in July of last year, and received a tremendous amount of comment on the growth of the industry from a whole variety of stakeholders, borrowers and lenders and investors and policymakers. And we have sort of compiled that work in the form of this report, which we published just a few months ago in May. And I thought what I could do is touch on a few of the themes that emerged from this report, as well as a few of the recommendations. And some of the themes and recommendations will hit on the broader themes I think we're talking about here in fintech today around data, access to credit, some of the risks, et cetera. So just to very quickly go through the themes, and this is, you know, laid out in our report. First thing I wanted to mention is that commenters really remarked that the use of data and modeling techniques for underwriting represents both an innovation and a risk. So that the emerging data-driven algorithms that many platform lenders are utilizing could well actually expedite credit assessments and, you know, make credit available faster, which is a good thing, and reduce cost and pass those reduced costs on to the borrower in the form of lower rates, which is also a good thing, but also carry risks. So, you know, algorithms, just because a result spits out of an algorithm, it doesn't mean it's perfect. It could result in unintended correlations or disparate impacts, you know, or fair lending type concerns. So that was one observation that commenters had. Second, that there's clearly an opportunity to expand access to credit. We see that more on the small business side than on the consumer side. At the moment, most of the activity in platform lending on the consumer side is focused on the prime part of the credit spectrum and is really more about debt consolidation. But on the small business side, that there really is an opportunity to expand credit there. As most of you are aware, coming out of the crisis, small business lending has not picked up in the same way as lending to larger businesses has. In fact, if you look at commercial and industrial loans issued under $1 million, they've essentially been flat, slightly down since their peak level in 2008, whereas C&I loans above $1 million have grown about 10 or 11% over that period of time. So there are structural issues affecting the small business lending market, and marketplace lending offers an opportunity to address that to some extent. Third theme that emerged was that these new credit models remain untested. A lot of these businesses obviously have emerged in relatively benign credit environments should really be tested through a credit cycle. Delinquency rates or charge-off rates start to increase, that obviously bears monitoring. Fourth, we found that, commenters remarked that small business borrowers will likely require enhanced safeguards. And so the suite of consumer protections that exist, the CFPB has done a great job in really promulgating those. Those analogous protections don't necessarily all exist for small business borrowers. And so the need for greater transparency in that area was observed. Transparency in general was an observation that many commenters made. The need for greater pricing transparency, the need for greater transparency around standardization of pricing and rates. And then the last two themes, one is that the secondary market for loans is relatively undeveloped. The securitization market, or the back end markets for a lot of these for a lot of this activity, while growing, is still relatively nascent. And finally, commenters remarked that regulatory clarity could really benefit the market, and that the government could play a very important role in helping drive the growth here, but that there could be additional clarity provided around the roles and requirements for the various market participants. So I just wanted to make very clear what some of the, we received over 100 comments, and we kind of bucketed them in those themes. Now, to turn to some of the recommendations that, we did a lot of outreach and thinking on our posture in this space, and so I just wanted to hit on a few of the key recommendations that we made in the context of marketplace lending. First is that, obviously these all come right out of the themes that I just talked about. First is that we support more robust small business borrower protections and would frankly support legislation to achieve that end. Second, that marketplace lenders really should provide strong customer service across the entire value chain, from origination all the way to the back end of repayment or even collections if that becomes relevant, that appropriate contractual or other mechanisms should really be put in place to align the interests of borrowers and investors better. Third, on the theme of transparency, we really like the idea and would promote the idea of creating a sort of a private sector-driven registry for tracking data in this area, and this could be broadly, this could be broadened out to other fintech products. In marketplace lending in particular, on transactions, on issuances, securitization volumes, on loan-level performance data, all of that I think would benefit the industry and benefit the public borrowers. Fourth recommendation was that, for this technology really to have quickly expand access on the consumer side, which, as I remarked earlier, is at the moment primarily focused on the prime side of the credit spectrum. It's important to somehow get to those consumers who are not as easily scorable under traditional credit scoring models, the thin client or the thin file or no file type consumers. And one way to do this is for marketplace lending or online platforms to partner with, for example, community development financial institutions, CDFIs, which for decades have been serving these populations, and you can imagine a partnership between these two types of organizations, where the algorithms and the efficiencies that a marketplace lender could bring is married up with the intimate sort of knowledge of the communities that the CDFIs serve in a way that distressed community credit consumers can open up. Fifth, as is discussed earlier around the IRS and in other contexts, we're very supportive of exploring innovative ways to access the data that the government has. Obviously, this administration has been a huge proponent through the Open Government Initiative of this type of effort. to make open to make data more accessible to entrepreneurs and innovators and others to really develop new products and services. And in the context of this particular industry, I think it could be very important and helpful to help drive the borrower experience and create safer and more accurate loan products. And then finally, parallel to the last theme I talked about, what we're doing at Treasury is facilitating interagency coordination in marketplace lending through the creation of a standing interagency working group for the sector. And the purpose of this group is initially really just information sharing and sharing best practices, but it also enables the member agencies of this group to identify areas where additional regulatory clarity may be warranted. So I just wanted to take a moment to kind of give you a lay of the land of the kind of the work we've been doing in marketplace lending. We obviously continue to very carefully monitor the industry, and happy, Aaron, to kind of expand the conversation beyond that.
I thank you, Anjan, and from my time in government and then my time outside looking at it, you know, coordinating the various regulators is a yeoman's task that often seeds great work that is fully underappreciated, because a few things drive me more angry than when regulators go in opposite directions, creating the kind of uncertainty that the first panel said, you know, slows down innovation. So everybody, each of you has brought up some really, really good points. And I kind of want to put you on the spot a little bit to think across these different streams and topics to answer the question of where do you see the single greatest promise for fintech to improve the lives for working Americans, and why, how, and how will it happen? And the things I've heard discussed are real-time payments, more and better access to capital for small businesses, lowering rates through improved underwriting, broader availability of credit in that kind of thin or low file, real-time information to allow decision-making on the spot, and probably a couple other have been brought up, more appropriate information. So what is the single greatest promise for fintech to actually affect working Americans?
So I would say, from the point of view of the focus groups that we did, is real-time payments. I mean, it is an enormous frustration for working people who are living paycheck to paycheck not to know exactly what amount of money is in their account at any particular point in time. And again, like I said, they're willing to pay. For example, mobile RDC, the picture version of your check deposit.
Remote check deposit
capture. They're willing to pay a modest fee to have immediate access to the funds, to have real funds. So, again, just because for these folks, time and effort is crucial, and the effort of trying to figure out, all right, this check doesn't clear till Wednesday, so I'm going to pay this bill. So if I pay this bill tomorrow, I'll probably be okay, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say real-time payments, which I think is coming, but the faster that gets here, I think the more the better service to the people we're talking about.
Yeah, I would say I think it's hard to pick a silver bullet, but I think that one is such a good one. The faster payments is such a good one, because you have people who, I think you pointed out, their income exceeds their expenses, but it's these timing gaps that send them to the predatory service providers, or maybe even not predatory, but expensive service providers. And that, I think, you know, the real-time payments just has the ability to solve for so many things. And it's not necessarily, you know, a flashy new product. It's just improving infrastructure.
I think we can all be in agreement on this one. But you asked us to pick two, right?
So yeah.
I agree with them wholeheartedly on the faster payments and the value there. I mean, you think about things like real-time payroll, products that are emerging, which can be so valuable to the consumer in having access to that cash on a real-time basis and not having to go out and make a two-week short-term installment loan or something to tide them over. But I think that, you know, I touched upon access to small business, but I mean, I think, Aaron, the other obvious, I think, high-impact area is just expanding access to the consumer base, if we can get there through notwithstanding the risks that I talked about. But, you know, the theory of the case is that more data, better data analytics will be able to drive lower costs, better credit decisions, and therefore be able to maybe get at some of these thinner no-file customers. Again, it's aspirational to some extent now, but again, it's an aspiration that we hope we can support, and I think could have real impact. So that would be the other area. There's one that you didn't mention, which I think is also important, which is security. You know, because from a wholesale financial services perspective, that's very important. But just from the consumer lens that we're talking about today, boy, I mean, we read about in the papers all the time these breaches, people's credit card information stolen, or you know, some of the health insurers have been breached, and PII, personally identifiable information in terms of health records, which is really sensitive stuff, gets out there. And if you think about the way the internet was developed, it was developed to focus on connectivity and interoperability. Those were features that were embedded into the design of the internet. Security was not, right? And technology has an ability to change that as we think about re-architecting these systems to embed security in a way that consumers' valuable and sensitive information is protected.
So let me pick up on that security point, because I think there are a couple things, right? Like, first, in, you know, when you think about there's this kind of unique moment where we've moved from this, you know, security is cultural in a way, right? In America, we give away our credit card. We don't allow line of sight. We put it in the bill and the waitress takes it away, right? In Europe, that never happens. In Europe, they have hardcore, you got to hold your credit card at all time. They have chip and PIN, right? In the U.S., we've managed to, in my opinion, land in the worst of all situations, which is chip, no PIN. So it's no more secure, it's twice as long, and it's just a horrible change of which I see very little value add. At the same time, you have phones with thumbprint technology, which has to be far more valuable. I mean, I've signed all sorts of crazy stuff in the credit card line, in the check. That doesn't seem to matter what you sign. But your thumbprint, I don't quite understand why with Apple Pay sometimes you still have to sign. I mean, they've gotten your thumbprint. I've never been turned down because my signature didn't match the back of my card. But like,
he doesn't even sign his own name.
Yeah, well, you know, the question about where's our legal and regulatory system ready for fintech is where I'm going with this, with security, because there are aspects of the security system in fintech where you go back in the history of Magstripe, which is the technology that underlines credit, debit, and prepaid, and when you really do a deep dive, you come down to this seminal bill called the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, passed in the 1970s. With this new questionable technology about debit card that had this great liability question. And you know, since we're at Brookings in the home of economic studies, I'll start with the Coase theorem. A famous Nobel laureate, Ronald Coase from the University of Chicago, who said the role of government is to assign property rights and then get out of the way. And I think of EFTA as this great example of that, where the government assigned the property right of liability, that is what happens if your card is hacked or stolen, assigned a very limited amount to the consumer, $500, and all the rest to the banking industry, and said, banks, if you want to have this new technology of debit cards and ATMs, you fix the liability because we've clearly assigned it to you. And lo and behold, consumers adopted the technology because they knew it was secure. Banks figured out the solution. I mean, I think if we didn't have EFTA today and we proposed it, you'd be laughed out of the room for putting all that liability on industry, yet it's worked wonderfully. I think the Bureau did a fantastic job in their prepaid rule, fundamentally not only extending the EFTA regulatory structure of the 70s to prepaid cards, which is kind of a huge innovation, but fundamentally the same technology, but then applied it to PayPal. And applied it, previously your PayPal balance, if you fat-fingered an email, was totally unprotected. If it went through a debit or credit card, it was protected through this regulation. But PayPal to PayPal, totally out there. And this is an example to me of how government regulation can modernize the existing structure without going back to Congress to extend it. What I guess I want to ask Anjan is kind of like where you think, first of all, do you kind of agree with that framework? And second off, through the interagency working group, through Treasury, where is it that you think you guys can start looking at that legal regulatory structure, apply it to marketplace lending to let that space flourish or other areas within the existing legal authority?
Well, I think it's a great question. I think Obviously, we live in a world where we have, in the U.S., a relatively fragmented regulatory environment for the financial sector with independent regulatory agencies. And I underscore the word independent. So what we do at Treasury, or we can try to do, is serve a convening and facilitating function, right? So the idea would be, as I mentioned at the very outset, we are trying ways to, you know, I think our role is to find ways to foster innovation in a way that supports our policy objectives around expanding access to credit, supporting privacy rights, and so on and so forth relative to this discussion, and, you know, cracking down on it when that innovation is actually running afoul of those objectives or law. And through this interagency working group, again, as I mentioned, you know, if we do this right, we will find ways to make clear to industry, as in some of the comments we've heard earlier, you know, what exactly where the obligations are and where we can to streamline, right, or to encourage streamlining. Just to broaden the answer out a little bit, I think government can play, a really important role as a facilitator or an initiator, and in some cases also plays a role as sort of a product producer to prime the pump, right? So let me give you a few examples. On the facilitation side, we all said that faster payments is more important. So the Fed has stood up this faster payments task force, which is, everyone should look this up. They have a great website, fedimprovepayments.org, I think it's called. So there's a faster payments task force and a secure payments task force, both on the, you know, themes that we're hitting on here, which is security as well as speed. And this is a very broad public-private partnership. The Faster Payments Task Force has something like 300 participants, public sector, private sector, large institutions, small institutions, well represented. They've come up with a series of criteria, 36 different criteria, and what they're trying to do is literally re-architect and revamp the payment system. And obviously the Fed, sits on our critical payment infrastructure, manages it. And so they're very focused on these issues that we're talking about today. In fact, last week they took in about 20 proposals from the private sector that are meant to hit all those criteria, such as they haven't been fully public on all of this, but the things they have been public on, they've said, you know, that when the payment recipient receives funds, they will have 30 minutes to access it. You know, the system's got to be open 24 hours a day, 30, you know. The amount of information that goes along with sending a payment should be minimal. Shouldn't have to, like, show up with my birth certificate and, you know, so on and so forth, right? So how do we make things more efficient? Same on the security side. So there's an important convening function that I think will drive. One of the other criteria is starting implementation by 2019. So this is not, like, decades away, right? Well, so that's one example of a facilitating. In terms of originating, you know, if you look at Treasury, we oversee the Direct Express program, where there are disbursements of benefits, you know, Social Security and veterans benefits that are put directly onto a prepaid card. And there are 5 million people that have this card, and many of them are unbanked or underbanked, right? So this is providing a real service. We just actually rolled out a mobile app that allows for real-time account balances in that program, and roughly half of that 5 million, from what I understand, actually have the mobile app and use it. So in that way, the government can actually serve as an example of the kinds of products that they would also be promoting. So there are many other examples we can talk about, but so just to broaden it out, beyond regulatory clarity, there's a facilitating function, and also sort of an originating function, I think, that could be played.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would underscore what Anjan said. I mean, and I think there's convening in two senses, which he's touched on. A lot of folks in this room know, right? They'll come to events like the Financial Inclusion Forum that Treasury had or the FinTech Forum at the White House. So there's that physical convening. But the marketplace lending white paper is another sort of convening and facilitating that government can do, right? It's hard to find another entity that can solicit input from a broad ecosystem, right, digest it, package it, and put it back out for the ecosystem in an authoritative and clear way. And I think it's an incredibly important function. Similarly, on the operational side, which Anjan also touched on, I think you know, whatever your feelings about chip and PIN or chip and signature, right? I mean, it's the government was able to do that with its cards, you know, as the private sector was still, and it just set the example.
Mm. So I'll address just the EFTA example, which I agree with you is a terrific example. So I think it's sort of important to distinguish the method of delivery of a product from the product itself. So what the CFPB, I think, concluded was whether your prepaid account is on a card or on your phone, it doesn't really matter. It's still subject to the modality by which it's delivered isn't so important. It's the nature of the product itself. Likewise with online lending. I mean, all the same requirements apply to online lending, even though it may be delivered purely electronically. You're not sitting in a bank, filling out an application and so forth. So I think I'm not sure we've yet been really confronted with a product that's a lot different than the kinds of products we've had. Mostly it's the way those products have been delivered that's changed. And so I think you have to look reasonably at whatever the governing regulation is and seeing how it applies in those situations.
Yeah, no, I think you're right in this in that space. And then having the courage and speed to actually go and implement the regs so the rest of the world sees it. We keep touching about real-time payment system, and you know the story that I started us off with about the woman, and Jonathan pointed out depositing her check. It got me angry because I remember starting in government when our goal was to get the unbanked into banks. If you could only get people low-cost bank accounts, you would transform their life. And here, you are seeing a person who has exactly that account being sent around the corner to cash their check to meet their real-time nature. And something that both of you said about real-time payment, something else the Bureau has done that I think is fantastic is this consumer complaint portal with the data. And when they did their deep dive in banks, one of the big findings from the Bureau was people were very upset about the email you get back saying your check has been approved for deposit. Because you get that back in real time. Do you guys all do that, where you get that email? People think that means that's where the money is. The money's there when you see your check has been approved. And no matter where in the fine print of the email it says subject to 2 to 3 days of delivery, blah, 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 that's not, you read approved and you say got you. And in fact, that's created a lot of complaints in the database. So I guess my kind of core question is, as Jonathan pointed out, I got a little bit passionate about this because it does anger me. Do you guys share the anger at the state of our real-time payment system? I mean, 2019, we're going to have an iPhone 10 before we have a payment system 2. I mean, do you think banks, do you think banks are going to be able to fix this alone without waiting for the Fed and the government? Will government fix it, or will there be a group of fintech entrepreneurs on our panel or out in San Francisco in the Bay Area who are going to fix it where we wake up one day and we've been, payments have been Uberized? I mean, do you think it's going to be fintech, banks, or government, or none? Are we going to be stuck in this slow payment world for a while to come?
I don't think we're going to be stuck in the slow payment world for too much longer because there is this process ongoing. So the senator was talking about how long it took him to get his brain around the idea of blockchain. I'm still struggling with that. It is complicated. And you think about what essentially a payment system really means. It means that every actor in the economy is tied into this system, and it's a medium of exchange for all the banks, all the merchants. It's immense. So I think you're going to see a lot. You're going to see people coming at it from a lot of different ways. It may not help you at all, for example. So there's one group of large banks that's doing immediate funds availability, and that's great if you're in that. If you're have an account at one of those banks, and the person you're paying has an account at one of those banks, it works. You're there, but everybody else has to get. It's got to be for everybody. So it's just I think this is a place where probably government has a central role to play even if it's only as a referee.
Right.
But I do think you're going to have rules of the road that give access on a fair basis to all the players.
So I've been trying to stay away from predictions lately because I was convinced the Red Sox were going to the World Series. but I was definitely wrong there. But I think that it's probably an all of the above answer, right? We're not obviously decades away from the Fed's reaching conclusion with its work. I think they've done a great job pulling together lots of stakeholders and dealing with a fairly complex issue. In the meantime, there's products that are developed, right, that help solve for that, both on the banking side, as you think about the banks that are, you know, they've been developing products and services to help you move money between banks a little bit faster, a little bit easier. You know, and then you have the fintechs working on this as well with sort of workarounds or other products that get to the same end. So I think it's going to be sort of a combination, but hopefully we'll get there sooner rather than later.
I mean, I think one of the fundamental issues, I guess, is that we have incumbent payment rails, right? And there's just, that's the world we live in, right? And to rip all that infrastructure out of the ground and recreate it is prohibitively challenging, I think. So we have to work around the confines of the constraints that we have, which is why I think, Aaron, it's very hard to snap a finger and come up with a solution, and why no single type of entity can come up with a solution, because, as Jonathan said, it is so there are so many actors that are interconnected here. But I think there are pockets of really encouraging activity in each of these dimensions, right? So we talked about the government initiatives, the Fed's initiatives, the clearinghouse, which runs the chip system, and I think is the single largest private provider on the ACH system, is working very hard on a real-time payments and settlement system. In fact, they're going to pilot it, not in 2019, but in the first quarter of 2017 is what they say. And that is very promising. I mean, that's real-time settlements and payment. Now, again, the reason why they can do that is they control that chip, that part of the infrastructure, right? So they have the ability to, on their system, to innovate. So I do think there are pockets of activity here. But I do, obviously, we share your concern. I would say that. To make a little bit of a technical point, there is law that covers your scenario, you know, on the books. The Expedited Funds Availability Act,
right. Yep.
Which is enforced through Reg CC, there's a whole like set of criteria there. But generally, it's overnight settlement. And when you don't have overnight settlement, which is based on a whole set of criteria, you know, are you a habitual overdraft person? Is it over $5,000? Whatever. There's all this stuff. Then it'll take longer for your check to clear. And in that case, you still get a minimum. If it's over $5,000, you get $200 the next day and so on and so forth. Anyway, there's...
Yeah, but no, it's a fair point, yet the check was good. The woman could have been given the full amount or near to that almost in real time, in my opinion, certainly with a less exposure to the bank. Now, their profit incentive is mixed in terms of their overdraft earnings if they deny her that, and in point, you know, in Reg Z, the Fed could also reduce the amount of time it's taken checks to clear, right? The only reason check clearing time has been reduced is because the number of check processing plants that the Fed ran was shrunk from 33 to 1, so now we all clear in one central zone, but that's still 2 days. They could have shrunk that. I guess to predict on my end, I think banks, either through the clearinghouse or otherwise, or fintech will innovate before government. I think one of those two will get there first. We'll see. The sooner the better for everybody. I guess in this role, let's broaden it out a bit about where you think government's role is as a partner for fintech. I mean, the three of you sit in three core positions leading, kind of thinking through deeply government's interaction. Is government going to be a partner for fintech? Are they going to lead? Are they going to follow? Are they going to be a service provider? Like, what is going to be that kind of future of the government fintech partnership?
You can go first.
Should I go first? I think I tried to hit this a little earlier, right? I think government can facilitate and it can also be a provider. At Treasury, we have set up what we call an innovation fund. It's actually called the Financial Empowerment Innovation Fund. And we have an appropriated amount of money through which we can actually fund really interesting research projects that are meant to foster innovation and payments and savings, right? And so that's one example where government can get involved. There's a really interesting case in this area. There's one grant that was given to an organization called Banking Up, which we'll talk about more. I think Treasury will sort of roll out a little bit at some point in the future. But it's a research project, and it's a pilot project, and it's really about low-income consumers that have a very solid history of responsible spending and savings using prepaid debit cards, will then be issued credit cards. And a mobile app will be given to them to help them manage their debit and credit cards, and also to push out useful financial management suggestions, right? So this is the kind of thing that we are funding, right? It's small scale, it's a pilot, but the idea is to find innovative ways to actually get at some of the issues that we've been talking about today.
Yeah, I think one way I think about this is, in sort of riffing on what Anjan said, is the facilitation point. But you know, one of the things I really enjoy about my job is I can think about all these questions as it relates to fintech, but because the breadth of what we do is so expansive, I mean, if you think about what the president has done for innovation writ large, whether it's the Open Data Initiative, whether it's visas for entrepreneurs, Demo Day at the White House, which was all about inclusive entrepreneurship and bringing underrepresented groups into the fold. My favorite was this little group of six-year-old Girl Scouts who invented a page turner for those who had sort of disabilities. And it was like made with Legos. It was very cute. but right, there's all these things that we don't necessarily think about as fostering innovation in the fintech space per se. But if you can set the stage for innovation more broadly through immigration policy, through opening the vast doors of government data and all these things, that will all ultimately help the fintech ecosystem among others. And so when you touch as many things as Treasury does or the White House does, being able to see the interaction between these different areas and making sure it's all sort of rowing in the same direction, I think is an incredibly powerful function.
I would just say the FDIC is a bank regulator and bank supervisor, so we have a little bit of a different function, I think, than Treasury and the White House. We really think about this in terms of the standards of the interaction between the fintech industry and FDIC insured, FDIC supervised banks.
Yeah, no, I think Adrian made the key kind of observation about the social contract, and in that I always think that a bank is a charter from the state or the federal government. It is not a license. And the social contract of a charter is somewhat different intellectually than that of a license. A license is a permission. A charter is fundamentally a state-sponsored thing, right? You probably know the legal history better than I do about where it goes back to the king or queen who could grant a charter.
Right.
I think the news that dropped on Political Pro, or somebody dropped that one of your fellow regulators who actually does give charters is going to be putting out in November the idea or some white paper. There have been conversations about fintech charters. So I think we're going to get back to this conversation, you know, both from the social contract space, the Adrian space, the kind of role of the regulator and the charter giver that Jonathan points out, and fundamentally, as Anjan points out, the whole point of this is to grow the economy, right? I mean, you know, the reason that we have fintech is so that people can use their money better, faster, smarter, gain access to credit, cheaper, wider, so that we can have kind of this entrepreneurial area. So I promised that we would be able to get out by 4:30 for everybody who wants to get to or home to watch the Nats game. I'll not give predictions on game five, but I've kind of monopolized your time and want to thank you all and thank everybody in the audience.
Thank you.
For this wonderful conversation.